Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. Thank you to American Airlines for sponsoring tonight's program. I'm Kerry Curtis, Emeritus Professor of Marketing at Golden Gate University, and I'm also a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. Tonight, we are here to challenge our own economic understandings with Inforum's program, Freakonomics, not to be confused with Freakonomics, with Chris Anderson, who is Editor-in-Chief of Wired Magazine. He's author of the bestseller, The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More, and author of the new book, Free, The Future of a Radical Price. Chris Anderson is here to discuss a newly emerging economy in which businesses are able to make money while charging us nothing. So let's open up our ears and our minds and get started. As I said, Chris Anderson is the editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine, author of The Long Tail and Free, The Future of a Radical Price. So my first question for you, Chris, is you make the argument that businesses can actually profit more from giving things away than they might by trying to charge for them. Can you explain that seeming contradiction?
You know, lots of things about free are seemingly contradictory. The word has at least two meanings in English. It has a kind of a long history, a somewhat storied history. It feels, as you say, like a paradox, and yet we experience it every day. I mean, I will note, for instance, that our words may be heard over the radio. Radio is free to air. Radio stations are businesses, by and large, and the way they make money is advertising. So the notion that you can give away a product, in this case content, to one set of consumers, in this case the listeners, and make money from another, in the case of advertisers, is 100 years old. It's the basis of most media, television, even print publications are subsidized to 90% or more, and by this third party, the advertiser. So we should not be shocked or feel that it is economically impossible to build a business around giving things away. That's not, however, what the book is about. And nor, you know, if I were simply observing that the media model is 100 years old, it wouldn't be very interesting. What is interesting is that the rise of the internet, but digital economics broadly taken to a global stage, has created a new way to make money by giving things away. And this is, you know, originally that was just the plain old advertising model, you know, put up your website, throw a banner ads against it. But over the past few years, we've invented something called freemium, where you can give away 80%, 90% of your goods for free and charge just 10% or 20%. We see these in things on online sites where you have a kind of a basic free version and a pro version where the few subsidize the many. And this is only possible in the digital realm where those free products cost almost nothing. And that's the unique quality of digital information, is that the so-called marginal cost of these goods is so close to zero that you can give that almost everybody can get the form for free as a form of marketing so that a few will pay for something more.
Thank you. One of the consequences of this free model is that some established industries are really under financial assault, like the newspaper industry. Local example, the San Francisco Chronicle, cherished by many of us, not for the quality of its news, but for other characteristics.
You said it, not me.
But they're teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, and a big contributor to that is Craigslist, which basically replaced the want ad section of the newspaper. So how can we rationalize that in our mind, destroying the value in existing industries and companies for this free thing?
The way you phrased the question is, and rationalizes, suggests a moral dimension, and I'm not even going to get into the moral dimension because this is really a matter of simply economics at work. Think of free as being like a force of nature, as being like gravity. Digital free is driven by the underlying cost of digital goods. Those costs are falling. Not only are those costs close to zero, but they fall by 50% every year. This is a unique character of digital information. It's Moore's law on processing and the equivalence in storage and bandwidth. What that means is there is this gravitational force to zero. If you don't make your digital products free, there's a huge opportunity for someone else to do so, with piracy of music being a perfect example. The music industry chose not to make music free, so the marketplace, quote unquote, did it for them. Is gravity a good thing or a bad thing? We don't really engage on a moral level. We just sort of say it is. What are you going to do about it? You gave one reason for the newspaper industry's decline, which is Craigslist and classified ads. But there are others. There is a much more important explanation, which is competition. There was once a time, there is still a time, when a certain newspaper publishes on its front page all the news that's fit to print. And there was once a time when that was probably close to, it's never true, but it was close enough to true that we didn't question it. There was once a time that if you wanted to get news about San Francisco, you had to go to the San Francisco Chronicle.
During the Vietnam War, that saying was turned into, all the news that fits, we print.
Indeed. So what we now have is another form of free, which is that, it was once said, never pick a fight with someone who buys ink by the barrel. What we have is we all have the capacity to buy pixels by the barrel. We have democratized the tools of production. We have, what cost the San Francisco Chronicle and my own publication and anyone else in the traditional media industry a lot of money to make, which is to say content put on paper, printed in factories, distributed in trucks, onto newsstands. There's a lot of money involved in all those steps. To do the same thing online is not only close to free, but in fact there are millions of people out there doing it and charging nothing for it, be it blogs or Twitter or Facebook or whatever, microsites or whatever you choose. They are doing it for reasons other than business. They are doing it for these non-monetary incentives, reputation, attention that we can talk about later. But the effect is either on the local, the micro-local level, or on the global level, on the opinion level, or on the business level, that you see this explosion of competition. And as you know, in basic economics, you can only make money from scarcity, right? If there is an infinite amount of something out there, it's very hard to charge for it. And what we have here is an infinite amount of competition for people's time. This pool of attention. When I say you give away content to create a pool of attention, then you sell that pool of attention to advertisers, that pool of attention is now much larger and shared by many more entities. We have a glut of inventory. And as a result, you're seeing a decline in both advertising rates and also the advertising is going elsewhere. Often to places that are more relevant to narrow interests. So that is, I think, a larger problem. Competition is a larger problem for the newspapers than the narrow question of classifieds.
Right. I was amused by the story you told about the time that you hosted someone from Google to come into your offices when you were assembling the next month's magazine. So you were laying out the stories and what order should they go in and where should this ad go compared to that ad. And this guy was flabbergasted because you worried about making
proximity.
The ads not be, two car ads, don't make them too close together. I don't know if you run car ads, but that just pointed up one of the characteristics of Google that is so unlike the magazine model. And can you tell us a little bit about Google and why it's such a powerful story in this free movement?
Yeah. Well, I'll just complete the story you raised. I'm in the media business. I'm a magazine editor. I work for Condé Nast. Condé Nast is Vogue and Vanity Fair, New Yorker, and GQ, and many other titles. We are a traditional media company. We buy, most of our revenues come from putting content on paper and distributing it the old-fashioned way. We like many media companies, we have certain ethics, journalistic ethics. We have certain principles. We have church and state and Chinese walls, and we take our responsibilities pretty seriously. One of those things is exactly as you say. If you have an article about a Ford car, you don't put a Ford ad next to it because that would be a betray the trust. That would presumably people would wonder whether that Ford article was in fact commissioned for the very sake of getting that Ford ad. So we separate them at least, and often try to keep them out of the issue entirely. And my friend from Google comes into the office, and he's just stunned. I mean, he says, you realize we do just the opposite, right? We put a Ford ad next to Ford content because that's called relevance. And there's two things to. There's two possibilities, two possible conclusions you can draw from that. One is that in this Google model, where ads and content are matched with such precision that it's hard to tell one from the other, we are building a potentially dangerous conflict of interest that may in fact someday break that element of trust. By the way, I doubt that's true, but that is one possibility. The other possibility is that we in the media industry were wrong. That we were wrong about what consumers wanted, we were wrong about where that trust came from, we were wrong about what they would think. That we maybe were arrogant and were taking ourselves way too seriously. More importantly, it was clear we had no way to test. We're not able to test in the way that Google can in real time with huge statistics and to find out what readers want. We were guessing. And we guessed that this would be a problem, and Google is suggesting that maybe it's not a problem. So I think that, I think this in this crisis, where we are rethinking everything about media, what we do, who does it, what credentials those people have, what form it takes place, how we monetize it. In this disruptive and, frankly, upsetting, industrial shift, we are going to reassess some of these basic premises of what our job is, what our responsibilities, what our readers want, and we're going to come out different. And it may turn out that Google was right and we were wrong. So you asked a question about, what is Google's place in the free economy? And what Google is at first a company built on free. So virtually everything Google does is free to you. Google doesn't show up in your credit card statements by and large. That's interesting in a couple ways. First of all, we don't think less of Google because it's free. You don't say, it's a free search engine. How good could that be? So that's interesting. So we don't necessarily, this there are a lot of cliches about free, which we will dismiss. Things like you get what you pay for, right? Well, with Google, you don't pay for it and you get the best search engine around, or certainly one of them. Second thing is the full range of products that they're able to offer you for free, subsidized simply by the ads on the few. So their spreadsheets, their word processors, the calendar, the Gmail, the Google Maps, Google Earth. I mean, 320 products at last time I counted, virtually all of them free to consumers, subsidized by this incredible monetization engine just around AdWords and AdSense, which is ads on content. The last way that Google is sort of the cathedral of free and also the kind of economic engine behind so much of the free internet is that they have a very simple way to take any site and turn it into a revenue generator. You can slap some code on your site, it will run Google's ads, and it will automatically be relevant and useful and you get money. So a lot of companies, and I'm not saying anybody makes much of a living off this, but I have several sites that they bring in hundreds of dollars a month by simply putting up these ads. So they, I pay my hosting bills, beer money, you name it. I can turn these I can turn my reputational credits, my attention credits, into money by simply pasting some Google code, which is kind of cool.
We had Michael Moore here the other day, and he made the comment that American newspapers and presumably other media companies perhaps way back when chose the wrong business model or revenue model, I guess. They chose the advertising-driven model, whereas the European newspapers chose a subscription-oriented model. So he said that maybe that was a bad choice. What do you think?
I think it's a really important and good question to ask. You can argue it both ways. So the European model, both models have a balance of direct revenues. So newspapers do cost money. you know, but it is heavily subsidized, whereas the European ones cost more. They're less subsidized, but both have advertising and subscriptions. But let's just reduce this to the, you know, to extremes. Let's call the American model free to consumers and fully advertising supported, and let's call the European one more direct payment. The downside of the American model is exactly what Michael Moore was implying, which is to say that our customer is not, in fact, our reader. Our customer is our advertiser. And that although our loyalty should be entirely to our reader, there is this pervasive and pernicious tendency, and the Chinese walls are there and the ethics are there to prevent it, but there is a tendency to bias things in favor of the advertiser. And when media goes wrong, it's because they're under pressure to serve the real customer. So that is the danger. The upside, however, is that by the advertiser subsidizing the content, more people can get the content at lower price. So, you know, we in the United States chose to make our radio free to air, make our television free to air. We don't, you know, in the UK, they have a television license fee. You pay an annual license fee for your radio and an annual license fee for your television, which is a tax, which then subsidizes the BBC. We chose to go the other route, which is the tax is then borne by the companies, and we get the content for free.
A little bit like the healthcare debate.
It is a little bit. I mean, you know, fundamentally there are costs and the cost must be paid. The question is who's paying. It worked really well for a long time. You know, I would say that, you know, the media by and large was pretty good about preserving those Chinese walls and pretty good about keeping those commercial pressures from influencing the content. But as the economy gets tougher and as advertising, the limits of advertising becomes clear, those pressures get higher and higher. And so I think what we see is an opportunity to reset that equation. And the difference the reason why I think that Michael Moore is probably right, this is a good opportunity to get the direct payments from the consumers, is not only that it realigns our interests with the interests of our readers, but that doing it in the digital sphere allows us to still make most of the content free to most of the users. And if we can get a minority to subsidize the premium and the freemium equation, those people who choose to subscribe to WallStreetJournal.com or FT.com so that it can be free to everyone else, then the 10% can subsidize the 90%. They are still readers, and so our interest is still aligned with the readers, but we're not withholding this information from the community at large.
Right. Like the story that you told about Monty Python, and how they were angry because of low quality ripoffs being put on YouTube of their sketches from years ago, and so they said, you know, enough of this. Well, why don't you tell the story?
Well, I mean, Monty Python was, you know, Monty Python felt about their clips, you know, dead parrot sketches and such being put on YouTube the way any of us would, which is they had mixed feelings about it, right? I mean, partly it feels like, hey, I'm being ripped off. Partly it feels like, how cool. People, you know, think enough of our stuff to put it on YouTube, and they're quite popular. You know, I'm glad to be appreciated. I'm glad, you know, to be part of this generation's media experience. But they, you know, they would like to both be part of the experience and make money. So the solution was not to call their lawyers and say, take down our content from YouTube. Instead, their solution was to make more content available, better content, and still free. So what they did is they went to their archives and they digitized their archives and they put it all, you know, lots of it, not all of it, but lots of it on YouTube, you know, properly labeled, nice metadata, a channel, really easy to read, looks, really, you know, fantastic channel. And they said, here, have it all, enjoy. But if you like it, you know, these are 10-minute clips, these are 7-minute clips. If you like it, you know, there's more. There are the movies, there are the DVDs. Sales went up, I think, 23,000%. They become the number two DVD on Amazon. It worked tremendously well. It's a classic freemium equation. You give away one thing, which has value, those 7-minute clips, etc., to drive some proportion of the audience. You upsell, essentially, some proportion of the audience to something that has even more value for which they'll pay. Work great.
The example of Prince, the rock musician, as in a similar one.
Yeah, well, Prince and you know, Radiohead, and you know, there are countless examples of this. But Prince has always had been an innovator in business models. What he did in the UK is he gave away his album in the Mail on Sunday, which is a daily newspaper. And what they did is these are atoms, right? These are physical discs. So what he did is he allowed the Daily Mail to the Mail on Sunday to reproduce it. at no cost. They had to pay the production cost of the CDs, but I think he charged them a small amount, but he allowed them to give them away for free. So in other words, he accepted the possibility that it would completely nuke all CD sales of his music in the UK. Possibly nuke all sales of his music in the UK. They were going to give it away free to as many people as possible. Why? Because he was going on tour. And he was doing something like 16 nights at Wembley Stadium, £300 or dollars or whatever for front row seats. And the free CD, you know, the commodity, the digital form of the music, was marketing for the atoms, for the physical presence, for the experience. The product became marketing for the performance. He's in the performance business. He makes more money from touring than he does from recorded music, and so too for the Rolling Stones and U2 and a lot of other bands like that. Radiohead did the same thing. Radiohead gave away their music online in various forms to both sell other forms of the music, box sets, etc., and to promote their tour. And, you know, tremendous success.
That's really an interesting... those are interesting examples and point to a different model. One of the things that I hear about a lot, and you mentioned in your book, is the issue of piracy, and it seems to be especially rampant in Asia. I remember visiting, I can't remember whether it was Shanghai or Beijing. I think it was Shanghai, my wife tells me from the audience. We were visiting the night market there, and some guy pulled on my sleeve and says, "You want this movie? You want this movie?" Well, I recognized the movie as one that was going to come out 2 weeks from then in the U.S. It was a U.S. movie, American movie. And somehow they had gotten a copy of it and created all these, you know, these pirated copies. So that was just amazing to me. But you make the case that maybe that's all right in the bigger picture. As China gets more prosperous, enough people will be paying for the content, for the software and for the music and so forth, to make it a viable thing for the music publishers and so forth.
Yeah, I probably need to nuance that. I don't actually say that it's all right in the sense of it being, you know, moral. I really don't actually address the moral dimension whatsoever. You know, I believe in laws. I believe in laws should be enforced. So I'm really taking that off. What I do argue is that it's the animal forces of economics at work. It is possible to reproduce digital content at almost no cost, and therefore people will do it. The question is, you know, what are the consequences of that, and what do you do about it? The story I tell is about China and Brazil, and I've spent much time in those same night markets, and I've seen the CD pressing plants. But now, of course, that was then, and now it's all digital online, and you know, in MP3s and such. The consequence, and I think Microsoft is probably a good example of this. Microsoft software was heavily pirated in China, and initially their instincts were to say, you know, shut it down. You know, get our trade reps to put pressure on Beijing to shut this down. You know, we are losing opportunity, and they did do that, and they continued to push, but they didn't push as hard as they might have. And in a rare moment of candor, Bill Gates explained why. He said, "China's developing. If they're going to steal software, we'd rather they steal our software. If pirated software lowers the cost of computing and increases and accelerates the pace by which Chinese adopt computers, and they adopt computers using our software, China will develop faster, they will someday be able to pay for software, and they will be hooked on our stuff. And they will become paid customers," which is, in fact, what has happened. And it's fascinating to see that what Microsoft did by sort of, you know, not being as draconian as they might have been about Chinese piracy is they created yet another market for Microsoft software. And, you know, China could have gone a different path, but they influenced China's path. And today, they treat startup companies exactly the same way. They formalized this process with a package called BizSpark. And what they say is, if you're a startup company, less than 3 years old and less than $1 million in revenue, you can have all of their software for free. The same reason. If you're going to use free software, we'd rather use our free software. If we can lower the cost of computing, you will develop faster. If you develop faster, you'll be able to pay us sooner, and you'll be using our stuff. It's fantastic the way they have sort of externalized the lessons from free and China and piracy into a business model for the 21st century.
Yeah, that's fascinating. What do you say to people who claim that they feel that they are paying for the internet because they pay a fee to their internet service provider, sort of think that, okay, that it's not free.
That's just sort of confused. There's a distinction between content and carriage, right? The internet is one of those places where you're paying for the pipe, but you're paying for sort of the volume of bits, but not the nature of those bits. There's a complete separation. So although your money goes to Comcast or, you know, or your DSL provider, it doesn't go up to the creators. There was no dispersion of that money to subsidize the products and services you get over. So there's absolutely no connection whatsoever between the businesses that run on the internet, the content and software and entertainment, and the act of accessing it. And this, by the way, dates all the way back to the original telephone. The separation of content and carriage was originated in the early days of AT&T, and the point was, you know, you're paying for the call. What the value of the information you get over that call? It's not AT&T's domain. It's none of their business. Whether that is chit chat or stock market advice from your stockbroker, it is not part of the economic equation. So that separation, people are confused because in things like your cable TV, you know, you pay both for your access and for the content you get. And they're confused because the internet comes over the same line, but they don't realize it's an entirely different model.
Right, yeah. After your first book came out, The Long Tail, which refers to the fact that on online sales, the low-volume products, there are many of them, but it's economically viable to sell them online, whereas in a retail store you can't afford to do that. So if you do a distribution, it has a really long tail on it, right?
Yes.
That there was a cottage industry grew up of academics trying to disprove or whatever the points you were making. Some of these professors I actually know. And so is that going to happen with your new book?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, it's interesting. The long tail is like free, it's kind of sort of self-evident, right? I mean, we all live in the long tail. You know, when you're online, you can have the mass and you have the micro. You have your common communal interests and you have your niche interests. We all, you know, my children are, by the way, completely unimpressed by all my books because it is so completely self-evident to them. They're like, Dad, you wrote a book called Free about how stuff can be free online? Duh, it's digital. And they're like, Dad, you wrote a book called The Long Tail about how there's so much stuff online? Duh, it's the internet. So I mean, it is kind of amusing.
You'll get smarter when your kids get into their 20s and 30s.
Yeah. So there's, you know, it is kind of, you know, it almost goes without saying, and I end up with these sort of these bipolar reactions to my books. I mean, you know, those of us who live, you know, here in Silicon Valley and on the internet, it's like, duh. And you know, in New York, where I just came from this afternoon, in the media world, they're like, it can't be. You know, my mother says, don't you know there's no such thing as a free lunch? And my children said, Dad, you dope, it's digital. And, you know, between duh and no way is kind of where I live. And the long tail is the same way. There's the traditional media business, the entertainment business that's like, blockbusters rule forever. And then there's those of us who live online who's like, you know, guess what? There's you know, we're all different. There's a lot of stuff out there, you know. Taste, you know, the variety. You know, we're drawn to variety, and we rejoice in our distinctions. So the academics are wrong. they're just confused, and they're confused because they tend to apply a standard percentile analysis. And you know, we could get into some details about what it is, but you know, they say, well, you know, it turns out, actually, if you look at the internet today, that rather than 10% of the content having, you know, 50% of the market, now 1% of the content has 50% of the market. It's getting even a smaller concentration. But that's 1% of, like, 10 billion. They forgot the denominator. They forgot that we don't live in percentages. We live in absolutes. And if my choice goes from 50,000 tracks in Walmart to 15 million tracks on iTunes... that is, you know, I'm now experiencing more choice. And if I'm now, you know, and I tend to indulge in that choice. I not only have more variety, but the tools with which to find these things. We are spreading our choice more widely. We are experiencing a more diverse world. And, you know, the academics are build a cottage industry in coattailing on pop economic theories. I guess had to find something to say, so they got their statistics wrong.
I'll tell them that.
Yeah. Oh, they know. They know. Okay. They know. It doesn't stop them, but they do it anyway.
In your book, you talk about these different models, and one of the important things that's happening is that people do things. They make gifts to the rest of us because they just want to. If you look at Wikipedia, it's fabulous, I think. You know, it gets criticized. But it's really just a labor of love by a lot of people who want to share their knowledge and so forth. And there's a parallel with that in the nonprofit economy. Here in the Bay Area, of course, we have a huge nonprofit sector. And a lot of people, like me here at the Commonwealth Club and lots of other of my colleagues here, we do it because it's just thrilling, you know. It's just great to be here and do that. And the people on Wikipedia are doing that. So, but again, that's something that's sort of taking jobs away from journalists or taking jobs away from tech writers and stuff. So what's your perspective on that gift? Was that what you called it?
You know, I mean, it is called the gift economy. I think actually that's the wrong word. The gift economy implies that the motivations behind a gift, I give you something, are the same as the motivations behind, you know, a Twitter feed or your blog postings or a Wikipedia entry, et cetera. And in fact, what we're realizing is that generosity is almost never the main motivation for this non-paid contributions. And there is no one motivation. Sometimes it's reputation. Sometimes it's attention. Sometimes it's expression. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes you're doing something for your own purposes, such as open source software, and you might as well share it. You know, why not? Maybe other people will help you. So enlightened self-interest, I think, is a much better. And perhaps if you explore your reasons for volunteering here, there's enlightened self-interest there as well.
I get to meet cool people like you.
There you go. So I think what we're realizing. So we have labored under many mistaken presumptions. I talked about some media presumptions we make, but one of the presumptions is that you've got to pay people to do stuff. Right, and another presumption is that the best stuff is the stuff that you paid people to do, and what we're now realizing is that these non-monetary incentives, tapping people's passions, you know, the volunteers rather than the conscripts, the avocations rather than the vocations, can often be as powerful, as good as the things you pay people for. And I sort of cheekily have argued that I will take a passionate amateur over a bored professional anytime. And yet we diminish the amateurs. We diminish this volunteer work as being somehow, you know, unprofessional, somehow, you know, substandard. And you know, the marketplace has decided differently. It's not the same. That's the point. You know, when you say, I get beaten up about this all the time because I am in the media industry, and yet I hugely champion amateur contributions. And I'm not doing it because I'm suggesting they will do exactly what we will do better. My point is they will do something different. What they will do is what is we are, our business model requires us to do mass, right? We're expensive, and so if we can't get a big audience, it's just not financially lucrative. What about the micro? You know, what about the needlepoint blog? Well, you know, I have a whole community about one about geek parenting called geekdad.com, and one about aerial robotics called DIY drones, right? Both of them are driven by passionate amateurs. The New York Times, you know, every day fails to cover geek parenting and aerial robotics. I can't explain it. Despite their professional abilities and the extraordinary, skills with which Thomas Friedman could cover aerial robotics and geek parenting, he disappoints me. So what's the failure here? The fact is there was a lot of topics out there that really didn't scale down, that the traditional media world and the professionals did not scale down to. It was just too narrow, too specific. And this is not just hobbies, it's also my neighborhood. My block fails to be covered by the San Francisco Chronicle every day. And I'll bet most of your blocks fail to be covered. And if your block is being covered, it's probably because you've had horrible crime incidents and something, you know, or potholes or something relatively unpleasant. But the reality is that our friends aren't covered and my children's soccer games aren't covered and failure after failure after failure at professional media. So where's that going to get covered? It's going to get covered by amateurs. And are they going to be fantastically written and beautifully edited? And No. But they're going to be relevant and they're going to be present as opposed to entirely absent.
I read an article a couple of days ago about a Guinness Book of Records new entry, cheapest feature-length movie ever. It was $243 for an hour and a half movie that actually played in a movie theater. So that just shows you what creative people can do just with their own resources and and so forth.
I will note that in, you know, back in the context of free, that what is the story of the last decade? But this explosion of contributions of work, and you know, we have collectively built the internet, and we've collectively built the internet mostly for free. The vast majority of content online is done without a business model, without any expectation of being paid, and it's being done for all these non-monetary reasons. This is where the competition for the professional media comes from. This is where the long tail comes from. This is where the reputation economy, the attention economy emerge. We are realizing that money does not make the world go round. Money is one of the things, but these other things can be even more powerful. So, you know, the free economy is not just a business model. It's also a cultural force. The fact is, it's free in dollars, but it's not free in detention and reputation. And when we go to pages and when we link to pages, we are granting them currencies. We are paying them with things that may matter more to them than our dollars.
Right, right. In your book, you make a point that that in the 20th century, and it's a shock to me to hear that referred to as kind of like past, because I'm still living in the 20th century, I think. But in the 20th century, economics made us think carefully about scarcity, but now we need to think more about abundance. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, scarcity is when you have a limited resource and it's expensive. You tend to be very careful about how you deploy it. The pages of my magazine would be a perfect example. You know, they cost a lot, and I'm a total fascist. You know, I say no to almost everything, and I'm incredibly careful about how we deploy those. YouTube is just the opposite, right? YouTube is driven by abundance. There is an infinite amount of capacity out there, and it's a large amount of capacity, and every year it gets half as expensive, and there's therefore twice as much of it for the same price. So if I'm running an NBC affiliate, I'm very discriminating about what gets on television. If I'm running YouTube, I'm completely indiscriminate. Everything gets on YouTube. There are no barriers. You know, there is now. When people first said, "Well, YouTube," you mean like cat videos, like, you know, and everyone says, "Well, surely isn't YouTube full of crap?" And the answer is yes, but that's what makes it so fantastic, because your crap is not my crap. In fact, my crap is almost by definition my crap. You know, so what's really interesting to me is videos of my children, which is of no interest to you. So, you know, it turns out two things. First of all, we're all different. We all have different measures of quality. My children, given a choice between watching Star Wars in upscale DVDs with surround sound on our projection screen with popcorn, or going on YouTube and watch Star Wars stop motion animations made with Lego by 7-year-olds, will take YouTube every time. The Lucas Empire, in all their focus group research, did not spot that the optimal form of Star Wars for 7-year-olds was stop-motion animations made by other 7-year-olds with their fingers in the screen. And yet that is what they want. It's relevant. So does it pass any traditional Hollywood definition of quality? Lighting, film, sound? No. It fails every definition of Hollywood quality, and yet it's relevant. And that is the ultimate definition of quality. So what YouTube is, by wasting video, we are doing this vast collective experiment in figuring out what the future of the moving image is. Every video that can be made will be made. Every videographer who can be a videographer will be a videographer. Every variation of the form will be tried. And we will discover that 30-minute sitcoms with happy endings is not necessarily the Darwinian optimum of what video can be. And maybe there is no one. And maybe, in fact, I grew up watching Gilligan's Island on television because that was necessarily what 12-year-old boys wanted, but because that was what was on. We confuse supply with demand. And with infinite capacity, by wasting the abundant resource of video online, we will no longer make that mistake.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest is Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine and author of the new book, Free. You know, we're talking about abundance, and yet in my share of consciousness, I think a lot about the third world and countries that are struggling. And is there a way that this incredible profusion of information and the ability to move it around can help all of those billions of poor people? And that's a simple question.
I will answer this with a story. The answer is absolutely yes. We now have democratized world-class information resources. Everyone has access to it. So I'm going to tell you a story. I mentioned before that I have this aerial robotics company. It's based on open source hardware. And when I went looking for a partner, for a CTO of my company, I went online, as one did, and went into the forums. And I was based on something called the Arduino platform, which is really geeky. But so I went to the forums, and there was this guy who was just awesome. He'd managed to fly a remote control helicopter with a Wii controller. It's kind of cool. Anyway, this guy totally impressed me. His name was Jordi Munoz. And we started talking, you know, we did a project together, and he was just the best guy in the world at this particular thing we were doing, open source aerial robotics. And so we decided to start a company together. And we started doing more projects, and I was sending money around, and at a certain point I thought, I should find out who this Jordi Munoz is. He was a 19-year-old high school dropout in Tijuana. He'd never been to college. English was not his native language. He'd got a Google PhD. He had taught himself world-class robotics on the internet. Today he lives. Today he's 23. He is still my partner. He lives in Los Angeles now. He's now going to college. Completely unnecessary, I'd add, but he's doing it anyway. But the editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine, when he went looking to find his partner, found the best person on the planet, and that person turned out to be someone, quote-unquote, from the developing world, the kind of person who 10 years ago would have neither been the world's best nor visible to me. But because he had access to the world-class information resources and because I had access to a long tail of talent, we found each other.
That's amazing. We're getting to the point where we'll have time for audience questions. So you might queue up at the mics here if you want to ask a question. But I've got one little cheeky question for you, and that is, if everything is supposed to be free, if information wants to be free, why are you charging $26.99 for your book?
Just so I get that question. It's the paradox in play. First of all, let me first say that I'm not arguing. And the most common misunderstanding of the book is that I am saying everything should be free. I'm not. I'm saying everything will be available. Everything digital will be available in a free version. But that is a form of But they will also be available in paid versions. And one promotes the other. So thus the book. The book is not $26.99. That physical, that Adams one, that's $26.99. But the others were, the bits were free. So the Kindle was free. The web was free. The audiobook, some were free for short periods. Some were free for long periods. The audiobook is free forever, anywhere in the world. In MP3 form, completely, DRM free, if you will. This is a freemium equation. I believe in the physical book. I believe the physical book is the premium form of a book. But if you want the bits form, it costs me nothing to give them to you. So you can have them.
All right. Thank you. All right. We're going to go to questions from the audience, starting with the young lady over here. Speak directly into the mic.
Okay. Thanks. I'm in my mid-20s, and I have already built up a bit of an immunity to advertising or gifts from large companies so that I become hooked on their product and then later spend money on it inadvertently. And I'm wondering what you see as kind of the next step after an entire generation or two becomes in disbelief of all of these free items all the time. The next thing?
Yeah, when you say you're immune, so I totally understand immune to advertising. Let's just grant that, sadly, but let's grant it. When you say you're immune to the free versions, I mean, for example, do you use Flickr?
Do I use what?
Flickr.
I do.
Are you aware?
I'm not exactly dependent on it.
Are you aware Flickr is the free part of a freemium equation, and that someday, if you put lots and lots of photos up, you may want more storage, and that'll be Flickr Pro?
Exactly, and that's what makes me concerned. I've already become that way with a couple of companies. YouSendIt.com, actually, mm-hmm. I was very dependent upon YouSendIt.com for years, and they started charging me to send things.
Right.
And I had already, you know, had all my access to all my friends using that company, and I had to kind of pull myself out of it. And now I'm very skeptical.
Well, there's lots of forms of freemium. Some are 30 days free, then you pay. Okay, you might be right to be skeptical about that. Some might be, you know, certain amount of storage for free, but if you become a power user, then you pay. So it could be the Financial Times, 10 stories is free, more than 10 stories you pay. It could be a game, you know, the first 5 levels are free, you know, then you pay. It could be, you know, Club Penguin, which my kids play. The game's free, but if you want a pet for your penguin, you're going to have to pay. You know, as long as it's clear about the, you know, the compact, about the deal, I don't see a reason to be skeptical. Now, if the deal changes, as it did with YouSendIt, now that's a problem. And if it's not clear where that dividing line is, that also is a problem. But with Flickr as a perfect example, you know, if there comes a day where you have so many photos on Flickr that you're so invested in it, I suspect you probably won't mind paying at that point because you've gotten so much utility out of the service. So I think it's about clarity, transparency, being sort of honest with consumers about what the free and the premium is and winning trust that way.
Let's go to a question over here at the other mic.
Thanks. I noticed that what you were talking about with the freemium model with the music business were acts that had already been built up by the machinery of the music business into global brands and had an enormous amount of reach because whatever they say gets printed in the newspapers. So I'm interested in what business model you would see for a new band starting now, given that people are used to listening to music that's recorded at high quality. Now, that doesn't come cheap, even if music equipment is cheap. For example, if you have a band of 5 people and you spend 3 months recording an album, you have an engineer and a producer, that's 21 months, nearly 2 years of people time to create a product, which you then give away for free. Then the revenue streams would be to go on the road. Now, a mid-level band isn't going to make money for 2 to 3 years on the road.
Got it.
And that's 5 people for 2 to 3 years. That's many more years of people time. So if you went to a group of investors and said, hey, we're going to make money after investing, you know, 15 years of people time into this product, and then, you know, maybe we'll... So how would the freemium model work for that?
You know, it might not. It might not. It doesn't work for everybody. So, you know, obviously there's you know, you this band will give away their music on MySpace, presumably, in some sample form.
That can be... There's a difference. What you can do online is you can stream. There's a big difference between streaming
and actually... Look, I'm not suggesting that every band will choose to adopt freemium. I'm suggesting that many bands do choose to adopt freemium. You know, the enemy of most musicians, and by the way, I spent my 20s playing in bands as well, the enemy of most musicians is that they're not heard, right? It's obscurity. You know, with the decline of the label, the label systems, came the decline of a marketing system. So free is a way to get heard. Now, how you turn your, you know, let's say you're good, and let's say you become popular, how you turn that into a business is every band's different, and many bands may not succeed. Now, of course, that has always been true, right? So most bands, most musicians don't quit their day job. Most bands never make a penny. Even those bands in the old model, and this, you know, let us not suggest that the old label model was some great deal for musicians. You know, most musicians didn't get signed. Most musicians who signed got screwed, right? So the fact that this model now requires you to be your own to be an entrepreneur, to figure it out yourself, to do your own marketing, to figure out what your business model is itself is, on one hand, harder. No label's going to do it for you. But on the other hand, empowering, in that you're probably, you know, that if you do it right, you're more likely to actually participate in the revenues rather than have some big company take all the money.
But I'm
Let's go to a question. I'd like to go to a question here at the other mic.
Thank you. Have you seen this model, or do you have an opinion of something like the Kiva.org model, where they're doing microloans or maybe micro equity to be able to raise money to develop content? Have you seen anything like that?
So just to be clear, this has nothing to do with free, but you're just asking the question broadly?
Exactly. As a way to perhaps solve some of the people's problems of how do you get money to develop content.
Yeah. You know, I mean, so there are people who are doing this. I mean, you know, tip jars of various sorts. Some of them literally tip jars. Some of them are more formalized, but subsidizing of content.
With an equity return?
Yeah, or? You've seen some experiments in filmmaking, et cetera. Nothing's blown me away, yet. I'm not sure we've found a scalable model that's going to work for everybody. But, you know, Kevin Kelly, my friend and co-founder of Wired, talks about the 10,000 true fans model. If you can establish 10,000 true fans, 10,000 people who really value what you do, you can find a way to get them to support you. Not every way will be the same, and it's going to take a lot of hard work to find that way is. And whether it's tours, or whether it's paying for content, or whether it's having them subsidize your development. Jonathan Colton, the artist, the musician, has made a good business out of giving away his music for free, establishing the 10,000 true fans, and then getting paid for it. And you're seeing some other. I think there's a couple other musicians who did in fact succeed by getting people to pay for the recording of their album, but I don't suggest for a moment that all artists will succeed in this. It's, you know, it's a work in progress.
Thank you.
I think the next question over here.
Hi. I lived in China for a while, and so I was kind of curious what your thoughts were on China as sort of a future market. Specifically, like, you were talking about the freemium model in regards to China, and having lived there, it doesn't. It seems like there's a very different cultural value on the value of things. I've seen many middle class people sort of pride themselves on finding a really cheap item instead of when they could have afforded like a really nice item.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if people are sort of really thinking of that model for China.
Sure. So I lived in China as well from 97 through 2000. I know what you're saying. There's two aspects to China. First of all, it's a developing, you know, economy, and so that introduces its own dimension. Secondly, there's a different approach to intellectual property in China. China did not, you know, Chinese tradition does not have a tradition of copyright and patent protection, you know, that sort of protection of intellectual property. As a matter of fact, Chinese tradition is built on copying the masters, right? This is how you learn in the Confucian educational systems. You really don't even try doing your own creative work until you've copied the masters. And so copying is not seen as sinful or even criminal. It's in a sense a victimless crime. And you know, it's kind of easy to see why you might see it as a victimless crime, because you're not stealing something from somebody. It's an opportunity cost, but you're not, you know, there's not a direct cost. So I do think there are those differences. As for the correlation between cost and value, I mean, it's not universal. Obviously, brands matter quite a lot. And, you know, I like you, I've seen a lot of people with a price tag still on their sunglasses, right? The fact that you paid a lot for the sunglasses is a form of status. The fact you wear your brands on your clothing. Sometimes you buy fake brands to sew on your clothing. To suggest that you did, in fact, pay a lot, again, a sign of status. So it's, I would say that it's developing, so don't think that it's lasting. It's, you know, that the way they are today is the way they're always going to be. And B, I would not say that there is a rejection of money as a sign of status. I think that's true for intellectual property, but not for physical goods.
So, Chris, I love your magazine and books. Thank you. I'm interested in projection. So when do you think when do you think what is happening to the Chronicle and other newspapers are going to happen to Comcast and television networks?
Wow. Okay, that's apocalyptic. So I don't think it's going to happen. I really don't see the parallel. You know, what the Chronicle suffers from is, you know, the things we talked about, competition and a sort of a fundamental decline in the revenue streams. Comcast has, let's just say they have two revenue streams, right? They have access and they have content, right? So when I pay them a huge sum, I'm paying them, you know, a little bit for the content, you know, the channels, and a little bit for the internet access. The world wants, you know, my wife just this last week asked whether we can cancel our cable subscription. Because we're getting so much of the content over the internet, whether it's Netflix on demand or Hulu or YouTube, it's really not clear we want that side of what Comcast's doing. But let's say we say, well, we cancel the cable side of Comcast, but we keep the ISP. Well, as we want more content online via the internet at higher resolution, faster, with less buffering, I'm going to want a fatter pipe. So Comcast will go from the sort of the content business into the dumb pipe business. It's a commodity business, but it's not, you know, I suspect I'll still be paying them a lot of money. And it's, you know, right now we do not have true competition at the home. I mean, my choices are, you know, cable, DSL, and that's it, pretty much. You know, I mean, maybe someday we'll have more choices, but by and large, shed no tears for Comcast.
The next question, this gentleman.
Hey, good evening. Adam Smith was the proclaimed, you know, father of our economic system, but he was also the chairman of the ethics department at the University of Edinburgh. Given that context, how do you blithely say, well, I'm skipping the moral and I'm going straight to the economics? How can you do that?
I don't have to follow Adam Smith's model, right? I mean, you know, so, I mean, there are scientists who are interested in the science of the ethics of science, and there are scientists who are interested in the science of science. I'm interested in I'm a physicist, right? I was trained as a computational physicist. I'm interested in the, in economics as a mathematical system. I'm interested in a marketplace as a kind of a Darwinian, evolution. I choose not to engage on the moral level. Other people can do that.
But you used the word apocalyptic a second ago to that other gentleman. That seems to me to infer something else.
I simply don't think that the market is. I don't think that it's likely that the market is going to decay as quickly as he implied. I don't suggest it's apocalyptic in the sense of a bad thing or good thing. I just don't think it's as dramatic as that. So again, you know, I'm a geek. I don't have an empathetic bone in my body. I choose not to engage on the moral dimension. There are other people more qualified than me.
Next question.
Okay, so what I noticed through most of your speech was that it was mainly media-related, free-based stuff, digital. Are there many, I guess, product-based physical free, structures or?
Yeah, absolutely, and we did not. The book actually goes in an entirely different direction. There's very little overlap between our conversation and the book. The book actually starts with Jell-O, and you know, in 1896, in the history of free as a marketing form, the sort of fake free of, you know, buy one get one free and razors and blades and all that kind of stuff. The history of fake free, and then most of the book is in fact not about media. It's about internet business models for software as a service. The video game industry figures very prominently in here as an industry that's switched to free to play. So I say this not just because there are books for sale on the back, and I want to suggest you have not got the book.
That's the freemium version out there.
But yeah. So actually, I get dragged into the media conversation because of my job, but it's not really where I'm focused.
But aside from media and digital, like in terms of physical product?
Yeah. So we talk about free cars and free, and you know, and the whole airline, how the seats can be free, and the college courses and conferences and
Those aren't free.
It's
the college courses aren't free.
The college courses aren't free.
Yeah.
Oh, so.
Oh well, I guess online.
Yeah.
But what I was saying is
the college courses are free.
But
you don't get your degree at the end, but you get the education.
Digital college course may be free, but I'm talking about actual material, real-world, tactile.
Yeah, trust me. Lots and lots of examples. You know, we can talk about cars. We can talk about any one of them. That's actually what half the book's about.
Next question over here.
Hi. I'm Andrew. I work for Boxy, so I'm glad that somebody mentioned us.
Nice.
I just wanted to ask how you see, so obviously, use the example of Prince giving away CDs and then selling the tour. How do you see that model evolving for an NBC or an HBO or something like that?
Yeah, obviously, you know, the analogy is not perfect at all. So I think the analogy there is probably going to be closer to iTunes, right? So music is free, right? I mean, I know that any music I want is out there for free, pirated or whatever. And yet I choose to pay 99 cents on iTunes. Why do I do that? Well, because I'm not buying the music. I'm buying the convenience. It's a one click. You know, I know. It's easy. I know where to get it. It's reliable. I know the quality. What I'm going to get is pretty assured. The metadata is going to be there, syncs neatly, et cetera. So I'm paying for a service, not for content. Why would I? You know, I also know the movies are out there, and yet I subscribe to Netflix. And same deal. It's easy. It's reliable. So when you're young, you have more time than money, and you'll hunt around on BitTorrent. When you're older, you have more money than time, and you just can't be bothered. I will pay for simplicity and convenience and reliability. And so what I think, you know, I think as you think of the content industry as being less selling content and more selling a service, you can see the answer to your question.
Some companies that have gone to the free route, like thinking of the Wall Street Journal, now they're kind of edging back to trying to collect money for their content online. Is that a trend, or is the free thing gonna just squash all of that to trying to monetize the content?
I spent half my life in New York, and it is infuriating how smart people, my smart colleagues, can misunderstand this so pervasively. So, you know, the Wall Street Journal, which I champion in the book, is a classic freemium model, right? 90% free or 80% free. I don't know the exact traffic numbers. You know, you can go, you know, their opinion's free. You can get any, by the way, here's a little tip for you, a little take home for you. You go to the Wall Street Journal, and you find a story, and then you get the first paragraph, and then it says subscribe for more. Well, here's how to make it free. Copy the headline, paste it into Google, and hit enter, right? And this will then bring up the story, and any traffic that comes via Google makes that story free. As a matter of fact, I've heard it actually makes the whole site free for that session.
Thanks for that tip. That's going to save me some money.
This is, by the way, not hacking the Wall Street Journal. They very explicitly do this because they value the traffic coming from Google so highly. So it's freemium. It's freemium. It's not like 100% free versus 100% paid. It's 100% free versus 90% free. And the Financial Times, et cetera. And no, you know, nobody in their right mind, in the mass audience, in the mass space, as these are, would go to a 100% paywall. It just cuts them off from the conversation. You know, you might make more money today, but you'll lose presence over time. You will eventually, you'll slow the pace of your money loss, but you will eventually go out of business. And so the question is, you know, how do you get the freemium model right? What's the pet for your penguin? You know, what is the right balance between free and paid? And that is what... That's the lesson we can learn from the Wall Street Journal, not that, you know, paywalls, go for it.
Right. You know, in my business, in academia, of course, we charge really large fees for information. So far, we're getting away with it. What's the free threat to degree-granting institutions, if any?
I don't think it's a threat at all, and I have a whole bit in here about things like OpenCourseWare. So more and more institutions, MIT, Harvard, and others, are putting a portion of, instead of putting their curriculum online, putting their lectures online. But, you know, if a university education was nothing more than sitting in the back of the class, watching the lecture, and reading the books, taking the tests, then, you know, then free would be terrifying. But it is more, in fact. The content is not the degree. It is the connections you make, is the interactivity, is the opportunity to have a connection with your professor and ask questions and get personal guidance, is the networking that you do, et cetera. The proximity, the social dimension is enough that the free bit is just marketing. And by the way, why not educate the world? Why not let, you know, Jordi Munoz and others have access to world-class education if it costs you nothing to do so, which is, in fact, what putting your curriculum and your lectures online does cost.
Right. There's always no matter how bad things are out there, there's always a silver lining for somebody. And the current terrible situation for the public universities in California is producing a little bit of a bump for us private institutions. We have one more question.
Yeah, so YouTube works as long as Google is willing to subsidize the bandwidth costs. How long do you think they will have to do that before they are going to break even? What's your guess?
Google has stated they will break even in the next 12 months. So YouTube is, say, what, 5 years old? YouTube has created a network-sized television audience, audience for video. YouTube is, obviously subsidized for a while, as many young companies are, but is now breaking even, and Facebook is breaking even this year. Twitter is going to break even this year, etc. So, whatever it cost them to do YouTube per video last year, it costs half as much this year, and it'll cost half as much next year. So, and meanwhile, the audience gets bigger, and their ability to monetize with advertising gets better. So, look, the revenue line goes that way, and the cost line goes that way, and it's really just a matter of time. So, when you say subsidize, you suggest that there's this sort of perpetual indulgence of a money losing business. But in fact, it's a short term creation of a business that gets better and better, more and more economically efficient and profitable. Actually at an extraordinary pace. I mean, we've never created and monetized an audience as quickly as YouTube has, and Google helped it happen, but it would have happened anyway.
Well, that's all the time we have. Our guest this evening has been Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine and author of the new book, Free, The Future of a Radical Price. And with that, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.